John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan, Carla Wills, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor, Demilitarizing the Pacific, on Wednesday, February 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Peace House in Portland. Demilitarizing the Pacific features three indigenous women speaking on the destruction of a coral reef to expand a military base in Japan, curbing military buildup in Guam, and peace and justice in Hawaii. Again, that's Demilitarizing the Pacific on Wednesday, February 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Peace House, 2116 Northeast 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering, a Women of Color panel, on Thursday, February 21st at 10 a.m. at the Abundant Life Church in Portland. In honor of Engineers Week, Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering features a panel of six local women of color engineers talking about their career paths and answering questions. The panel is moderated by Cheryl Norris. Again, that's Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering, a Women of Color panel, on Thursday, February 21st at 10 a.m. at the Abundant Life Church, 3935 North Lombard Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to community-supported KBOO Portland. Cecil and Celeste have President's Day off. Coming up next is going to be the Scholars Circle with host Maria Armudian. First, a guest is going to be Nancy Gibbs speaking about her book, The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Then they'll take a peek inside the strange political marriage of Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon and how their term shaped U.S. politics and policy. And then that's coming up right next on KBOO Portland.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, for President's Day, we'll explore the strange political marriage of Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon and how their terms shaped U.S. politics and policy. And first, we'll speak with Nancy Gibbs about one of the world's most exclusive and influential clubs, the President's Club. Nancy Gibbs is a visiting professor of practice at Harvard Kennedy School. She's also the editor-at-large of Time magazine and the co-author of The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. The interview was recorded prior to Trump's election, therefore does not include a discussion about President Trump.
It may be the most exclusive club in the world, and possibly one of the most influential on world politics. The President's Club is a clique of U.S. presidents, past and present. How much do past presidents influence the sitting president on important policy issues? Who do sitting presidents turn to on issues that only a president can understand? With us is Time magazine editor Nancy Gibbs, who looks behind the scenes of this exclusive club for the new book, The President's Club. Welcome, Nancy Gibbs. Great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So the President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity, you open the book actually with an intro about how George Washington, even though it wasn't a formal club at that point, how his impact kind of laid the groundwork for this to emerge.
He had a lot of important decisions to make, one of which was whether to even become a former president. There were plenty of people who would have been happy having him be president for life, and his decision to step down after two terms and to therefore establish the precedent of, you know, a peaceful transition of power and limited service was the first most obvious important decision. But then when his successor calls him back into service as commander of the armies, he also established the precedent that former presidents who retain a lot of prestige and stature can be very useful to their successors.
It seems the assertion of the book is really that this President's Club does, in fact, shape history in some ways.
When we first started thinking about this book, we were using the idea of a President's Club as a metaphor, basically, of just the men who either are or have been president and what happens when they get together. The more research we did, the more we discovered that it is a much more real thing among these men than we had realized. It has rules and rituals and protocols. It has souvenirs. You know, at one point, Lyndon Johnson gives Dwight Eisenhower a pair of cufflinks with a presidential seal on them. And he says, you know, you and Harry Truman are really the only two guys who can legitimately wear these. But you notice it doesn't say Democrat or Republican on them. They use the term club with each other. You know, Reagan writes Jimmy Carter a letter that starts out, you know, since we're both members of this rather exclusive club of ours. But what really made us realize how much more real it is was when my co-author Michael Duffy discovered there is even a clubhouse in Washington on Lafayette Square across from the White House, an unmarked townhouse that only four men in the world are allowed to check into. They have to call the White House to make reservations, and it is solely for the use of former presidents. So at that point, we realized, yes, it's an idea, but it is also some institution that they are very aware of joining and of the sitting presidents of using as an instrument of presidential power. It's an instrument of power that's not in the Constitution, it's not in any textbook, but every president we studied found some way to use the club to his advantage and often to the country's advantage on missions that really no one else could perform other than a former president.
Yeah, it seemed like the big theme was primarily foreign affairs, though not exclusively. What would you say the most prominent area of policy was that was impacted?
Well, you're right that it usually is foreign policy, and there are a couple of reasons for that. It wouldn't really be appropriate for former presidents once out of office to be terribly involved in domestic policy. But because they tend to have developed very important relationships with overseas leaders, and because of the stature that attends to a former president, there are missions that they can undertake much more successfully than an ambassador or any other emissary. Our story really begins with the most unlikely of all of these presidential pairings, which is Harry Truman secretly mailing a letter, not telling anyone on the White House staff. It's the spring of 1945. He'd only been in office a few weeks. He secretly mails a letter to Herbert Hoover, asking Hoover to come in and talk to him. Now, this is to the horror of the Roosevelt loyalists in the White House, who are still mourning Roosevelt's passing. They're suspicious of Truman. And the idea that he would reach out to their mortal political enemy, Herbert Hoover, was just, you know, mortifying. But what Truman understood was that Herbert Hoover, as he told him, knew more about feeding hungry people than anyone alive. He had done it for Woodrow Wilson after World War I. He had been an engineer by training, and this was basically the problem of figuring out how to get food to people in Europe in the immediate months after the war when there was a risk of mass starvation. That was the problem Truman was facing. And that Hoover, as an engineer, as someone who was really good at complicated puzzles, and with his stature, of course, as a former president, could help persuade countries that had food to get it to the countries that needed it. It was just this enormous sort of jigsaw puzzle. And so Truman basically calls him in. The two men meet. They're very suspicious of each other, but they are both very committed to avoiding what could have been a devastating catastrophe in Europe. So the next thing you know, Truman is sending Hoover to 22 countries, 50,000 miles around the world. He meets with 36 prime ministers and seven kings and the Pope, and negotiates all of these deals to move food around and to prevent this mass starvation. You know, that is a classic example of something that a former president could do for a sitting president that exists outside of policy and politics. Didn't matter that Truman's a Democrat, Hoover's a Republican. It was a goal that they both shared.
It's outside of partisanship, but they had to at least agree that they needed to feed the starving people.
And they had disagreements about the value of mandatory food rationing versus voluntary. There always were going to disagree about how you execute something. But what we kept finding was that when it came to foreign policy, the President's Club is most useful when there is some diplomatic knot that needs to be untied and a former president is the right emissary to send. Having said that, what really interested us most were not the encounters that were taking place sort of on the world stage or on the public stage. What interested most was when these guys pick up the phone and call each other just because they need to talk. And the relationships that form between them that are based on the scars they all share and the fact that once you have been in that job, the job changes you. And whatever you thought going into it, you know, the first President Bush told us, you know, you campaign for the office, you think you know what it means to be president. It all changes the day you get your first intelligence briefing. And then you realize what you're up against. So what we found is that it's a very, very, very small circle of people that understands the decisions that you have to make and the burden that that places on you. And they all come out of that office, even the successful ones, even the ones whose decisions turned out well, they all come out of the office with scars. And there are very few people they can talk to about it. That was what really struck us. So these friendships that developed and these partnerships that developed among men who had nothing in common politically, nothing in common personally, but were very tightly bonded just by the experience of having sat in the chair.
Let me remind listeners that we're speaking with Nancy Gibbs, and the book is called The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. The interview was recorded prior to Trump's election, therefore does not include a discussion about President Trump. Well, let's talk about some more of these relationships. I thought Ike was particularly interesting, President Eisenhower.
He's a very interesting one. He sort of looms very large over the first part of the club's history, and which, of course, makes sense. Here's a guy who was not a politician. The first office he ever ran for was president. No one even knew what party Eisenhower belonged to until the 52 campaign. And he, you know, here's the man who had saved Western civilization. So he was unique in the position he had on the national stage, both going into his political life and then coming out of it. When he was president, he did not have a whole lot of need for advice or help or support from either Truman or Hoover. Many of these relationships we find take a lot of twists and turns. So Truman and Eisenhower had worked very warmly together during Truman's presidency. They really sort of helped build the post-war security structure of the Western alliance. The idea of creating NATO and being able to sell a very suspicious Republican Congress on permanently stationing U.S. troops in Europe, radical idea. Truman knew he would need someone with Eisenhower's stature to help him put in place the kinds of measures like NATO that he was trying to institute. So the two men were really partners until the 1952 campaign. It all comes apart. It just turns into the most virulent kind of blood feud between two guys that basically comes down to Truman feeling like Eisenhower, upon becoming a politician, had become a coward, a political coward, a moral coward, for refusing to stand up to Joe McCarthy. And so the two men have a very bitter split. Truman basically travels around the country. He's not running for re-election. He's not running against Eisenhower. He travels around the country running against Eisenhower, saying the guy's unfit for office. So it's probably not surprising that all through Eisenhower's presidency, there's scarcely a birthday card from the White House. Truman does not step foot back in the White House during the Eisenhower years. But that would be the end of the story, except, again, there's always a twist. So in this case, the two men find themselves together again at a series of funerals. The first is for George Marshall, ironically enough, since he was the one that Truman thought Eisenhower should have defended more faithfully against McCarthy. But they really find themselves reconciled as they're sharing a limousine together, riding home from Arlington Cemetery and the burial of President Kennedy. And of course, naturally enough, they start talking about their own burial plans and about what they think had happened, whether they think the assassination was a conspiracy. There's a sort of a layer of mortality over this conversation, so that by the time they get back into the city, Truman can turn to Eisenhower and say, you know, you want to come in for a drink? And they end up, you know, in the twilight, sitting together at Blair House, having a drink and talking about what they have learned and what they did and what they were up against. And again, by this time, they're both former presidents. They both carry the memories of missed opportunities, things they were proud of and will never get credit for, things they got blamed for that they couldn't have prevented. These are all the experiences that two presidents have. So Eisenhower and Truman end up being reconciled that night, even as these two are reconciling. Lyndon Johnson, who's now suddenly president upon Kennedy's assassination, that night, the night of the assassination, calls Eisenhower, says, I've needed you for a long time. I need you more than ever now. Eisenhower gets in his car the next morning, drives to Washington, comes to see Johnson at the White House. The two men have lunch together. Eisenhower writes out in longhand on a legal pad, here's what you need to say to a joint session of Congress.
I thought that was amazing.
It was amazing. Because again, here
yeah,
you
he
have
actually
a...
told him
pull us together, right.
Yeah.
Continue Kennedy's legacy. Kennedy's entire legislative agenda, by and large, was stalled in the Congress. The civil rights and education, the reforms Kennedy wanted to institute, were not happening. Eisenhower's advice to Johnson is get up in front of a joint session of Congress and promise stability and continuity and that you are going to fulfill the legacy of your slain predecessor. So you have a Republican former president telling a Democrat to pursue this Democratic agenda that had been unfulfilled. And this is really about Eisenhower's judgment of what the country needed at that time, what the world needed at that time to see stability and continuity coming out of the United States.
It was also remarkable that he practically wrote the speech out, and he wanted Lyndon Johnson to take it on as if it was an act of God putting him in the presidency.
Well, this is the way these guys tended to think. When you are in the position they're in and facing the challenges they face, you know, the stakes are very, very high. And often it helped them. It was a comfort to them to feel that God was watching over them and had their back. And this was something they would often reassure one another of.
One of the things that I thought about with Eisenhower in particular, and Johnson in particular, and what seemed hard to reconcile is that Eisenhower was the president who essentially dismissed the idea of overspending on military, warned against the military-industrial complex, and yet President Lyndon Johnson really escalated that Vietnam War.
Right, you picked up one of the things that really surprised us, because all through his presidency, one of the things Eisenhower was proudest of was avoiding getting into another war. He got us out of Korea. He avoided with Hungary, with Kamoi and Matsu, with Lebanon, one crisis after another, in which there was often enormous pressure to send U.S. troops. And he wouldn't do it. The Suez Crisis, again and again and again. And certainly Vietnam. And he, partly because, of course, of his stature as a great military leader, it may have been easier for him to resist some of these pressures. But one of the things that he was most proud of was that there had been no more, you know, American casualties on his watch. Johnson comes into office. There's a lot of evidence that he's very skeptical about Vietnam and getting, he's calling Vietnam a mess early on. Eisenhower now is sounding much more hawkish about Vietnam than he had when he was in office. And he comes to Washington, you know, Johnson is always calling him. He even would call him and say, could you make up some excuse to come to Washington? Because I really need to talk to you. There was one occasion where Eisenhower actually ran the meeting. You would have thought he was still president, as he is talking about the importance of being clear and consistent and basically using overwhelming force. If you're going to go in, you have to go all in. And he was much more hawkish about Vietnam as a former president than he had been as a sitting president. And I think that carried a fair bit of weight with Johnson. Remember, it's easy to forget now that we know how the whole thing turned out, that in, you know, 1965, 66, what we're talking about, the American public was much more in support. The administration, including holdovers from the Kennedy administration, there was much more consensus about the need to draw a firm line in Vietnam, the fear of dominoes falling, of losing Southeast Asia. That was not a controversial position, but Eisenhower was very much one of those voices, and it was a very influential voice with Johnson.
It's really quite a juxtaposition when you stop and think about that, how he left his presidency and then how he continued his foreign policy in a completely different direction.
Well, he carried a lot of weight, obviously, because of his stature, but where he was very useful was he really did believe, and this is sort of one of the club protocols, that especially on foreign policy, it undermines a president to have criticism, especially coming from a former president. And he refused to do it. So even after the Bay of Pigs, you know, 4 months into Kennedy's presidency, he has this foreign policy fiasco. It's a disaster. The entire world is denouncing U.S. policy. And Eisenhower comes and meets with Kennedy. They spend, you know, an afternoon walking the paths of Camp David. Many people remember those famous photographs of the two men together. And in private, Eisenhower grills him about what went wrong and the decisions he made and how it had all gone so bad. But in public, Eisenhower says, I think it's the duty of all Americans to support our president. And he privately warns Republicans in Congress, no witch hunting. We need to move on. And again, this is partly because when they were president, they did not like having shots taken at them by former presidents. But even more, when you've been president, they all have this feeling that the United States needs the presidency as an institution to work. They need it to be strong. They need the president to be able to speak with real authority. And so they are very, very careful about anything that could undermine the presidency itself. That can be a line to walk. If you think the president's policies are wrong, how do you, you know, criticize a policy without hurting the office? We see this to this day, where George W. Bush comes out. He's been very, very quiet for 3 years. He said, you know, when he left office, that President Obama deserves my silence. When he's asked about, would you have done anything differently? You know, he, of course, hopes that the tax cuts that bear his name will be continued. But then he says, he catches himself and he says, but I don't think it is good for our country to undermine our president, and I don't intend to do so. And that is as clear a sort of statement of the protocol as anyone has ever made.
And President Obama, of course, has also carried out the legacy of not pushing a prosecution of anybody from the Bush administration, too. So there's that sort of deference for the office of the president.
We've seen again and again of the times where presidents most often act against their own self-interest or their party's interest tends to be when they think there is something that is damaging the presidency. So this is how you have Gerald Ford trying to cut a deal to avoid a whole Senate impeachment trial of Bill Clinton. It's not because Ford was so eager to have Clinton get off without a problem. It was because he thought that entire spectacle would be damaging to the prestige and the power and the stature of the office. And that's what he was trying to avoid. And we see this in the 1960 election, incredibly close election. A lot of people are telling Richard Nixon to challenge Kennedy's victory. And both Eisenhower and Herbert Hoover, two Republican presidents who have no desire,
didn't like Kennedy at all,
didn't want to see him in the White House, but they both counseled Nixon not to press the challenge. They say it would not be good for the country. A lot of countries around the world are looking to the United States as an example. Countries in the post-colonial age are figuring out what form of government to embrace. We don't want a spectacle of anything other than a smooth transition of
power
at this time.
Does this help explain why Vice President Al Gore didn't challenge the election results? I can't even call them election results because it was not really the exact election result.
I think it was very much a part of it. And I think Gore was someone who was steeped enough in these institutions and these traditions that he had a choice to make about, you know, what he believed at the time. And since then, we've had the recounts and we know that actually, you know, we know how it turned out. But at the time, even though Gore had grounds to feel like it had unfolded in a way that was unfair or unjust, that the cost to the country, the cost to our institutions was going to be too great. One of the things outgoing presidents warn the new guy is you are only going to make hard decisions. All the easy decisions get made lower down the food chain. A decision that makes it to your desk, by definition, is a hard one, or else you would not be the one deciding it. And it means that there's a really good argument for going either way. That's what makes a decision hard. And so whichever choice you make, and again, even if it turns out to have been a good one, there are always reasons to regret the road not taken. And you know, really good arguments for either side. And this is one of the reasons why the office is so difficult to carry. And it's why you come out of it regretting even successful decisions, much less the unsuccessful decisions. But even the successful decisions often still come at a cost of human life, come at a cost of suffering or dislocation or difficulty to people. And so this is something that, you know, it is so much a part of the job to make these hard choices. You know, President Clinton said there's this just natural sympathy we have for each other because of what we went through.
Right. It is quite fascinating. One of the most interesting aspects, I thought, was that President Carter was a misfit from beginning to end, even within the presidential club.
Isn't that funny? He could both be, as he has said, and as many people have said, a more successful former president than he was a president. He's done amazing work around the world through the Carter Center in relieving terrible diseases, in promoting democratic elections around the world. And yet, just as he was sort of a loner in office, he's a loner out of office. There's a famous picture from 2009, right before President Obama's inauguration, where President Bush invites the whole club to the White House for lunch. And you have a picture of all five men standing in the Oval Office, and there's Carter sort of off on his own. It is not as though the guys had just been having some big fight about policy. We talked to President Carter about this. He says, you know, we were talking about what it's like to live in the White House. And of course, interestingly, a lot of those men could help President Obama with what it's like to raise daughters in the White House. President Carter, President Clinton, President Bush all had had daughters as the Obamas do. And so, you know, how do you keep this very strange life you're going to be living from making your family life impossible? But yes, Carter was both someone that his successors called upon because he could be very useful to them. He solved some of these thorny diplomatic problems, but he also has a way of thinking he knows better and would not always stay on script. And so you would find the president's kind of agonizing. At one point, Bill Clinton says to George Stephanopoulos, you know, I was going to send Carter. You think that'll be okay, don't you? Because on the one hand, he may be the only guy who can get the job done. On the other hand, you never know what exactly he's going to say or do. He was a very interesting sort of outlier character. But one of the things I've been reminded of, the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, Carter obviously had to deal with his unsuccessful attempt to rescue the hostages in Iran. In both cases, you had very hard presidential decisions, you know, very high risk, very high stakes, very difficult, rather separate from whether the mission succeeded or not. So I couldn't help but thinking, what if Carter's effort had turned out differently? What if President Obama's effort had turned out differently? And ultimately, these are not the guys flying the choppers. So in terms of the willingness to make a brave, difficult, risky decision, they're very similar. Sometimes the decision goes well, sometimes it doesn't. I think it is a reminder again that even though no one is sort of allowed to complain about being president, you know, you've spent often much of your life and certainly the previous years before becoming president campaigning for the office and fighting like mad to get it, you're not allowed to say, boy, this job's a drag. But if you look in the diaries and you look at the phone calls and you look at the letters, you will hear these presidents basically saying that there's a lot about this job that is really hard and really difficult. And the only guys that they can really talk to about it who will not sort of say, well, quit whining, are the other guys who've had it, both because they know and because they know there isn't really anyone else they can talk to about it.
And then there's this aspect of how you've shown it in many of the relationships. There are points where they're very icy and there are points where they're not so icy. And Clinton and Carter was one of those examples where it was icy for a bit until North Korea.
And, you know, here's a classic case where at a period where tensions were rising between the U.S. and North Korea over North Korea's nuclear program, and there was a real risk of even military confrontation. And so Clinton sends Carter to go basically on what was meant to be a sort of intelligence gathering operation to assess what North Korea's intentions were and whether we needed to proceed with very tough economic sanctions or potentially military action. So Carter goes over and he meets with the North Korean leader. And not only does he not just assess intentions, he ends up cutting a deal that would allow UN inspectors back into the nuclear sites and avoid the imposition of sanctions, which you would have said was a great diplomatic breakthrough, except for the fact that Clinton and his national security team heard the details about it when Carter went on CNN to announce his breakthrough. So on the one hand, if you're sitting around in the White House, are you thinking, oh, great, he cut a deal, or oh, my God? I think the word treasonous was used at the time, and words I can't use on the radio. It's a classic case where Carter was able to very successfully untangle a really tough diplomatic knot, but did not exactly go by the rules that the first person you brief about any of your missions is your commander-in-chief.
Do you get a sense that this President's Club is part of what helps us understand continuity? So, for example, President Obama had made some promises about foreign policy in particular that are, Guantanamo Bay being one of them, not being fulfilled. Do you get a sense that that's partly as a result of this club and the relationships that have developed and the advice that goes back and forth?
I don't know that it's about the advice, but it is about something that is a key characteristic of the club, because it's a key characteristic of the presidency. And it's one of the reasons why presidents tend not to criticize each other. And it is that, of all people, Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame told Henry Kissinger after Nixon was elected in 1968, so Kissinger is now going to be coming into the inner circle, and it's Ellsberg who says to him, you know, once you are in that circle and you are now have access to the most highly classified information, the president and his very closest national security advisors, and you see what we really know and you see what threats we really face, it completely changes the way the world looks and it changes the kinds of decisions that you make. I think it's probably safe to say that what candidate Obama knew and believed was wise or possible regarding national security changed dramatically when he became President Obama and was getting those briefings himself. This, again, is not to say the presidents should suspend their critical faculties or do whatever the generals or the spooks tell them. But the world does look very different when you know everything. And so one of the things that we kept hearing, even from President Bush Sr. about President Bush Jr., was when he would not criticize. It was not just that he would not criticize his son. He would say, I'm not read in. I don't know what he knows. I don't have all the information that he's acting on. John F. Kennedy said, no one has the right to judge a president unless they know what crossed his desk, unless they know what information he based his decisions on. And very often we only have that information 10, 20, 50 years later with the declassification of documents. The presidents are very mindful that outside of that inner circle, we don't know what we're talking about.
Well, let's end on a lighter note. You described two presidencies, Bill Clinton and Bush, as Oscar and Felix of American politics.
I think it's fascinating alone that we had father and son presidents in our lifetimes. The fact that the president in between also became a member of the Bush family. Barbara Bush has talked about her husband as being the father that Bill Clinton never had. Clinton never knew his father. He became very close, particularly to the first President Bush. The rest of the family has a nickname for him. They call him their brother from another mother.
I thought that was very funny. The son, President George W. Bush, had a quote, and you named a title after it. Tell 41 and 42 that 43 is hungry. I think that's what it was.
Well, I believe it was at the opening of Clinton's library. Presidents take presidential libraries seriously. They consult each other about them. They commiserate over having to raise money for them. They appear at the dedications. They even talk about, you know, where they're going to be buried at their libraries. In this case, the first President Bush and President Clinton had wandered off and were talking, and so 43 was sent off the message. Tell 41 and 42 that 43 is hungry. I think
that.
At one point the Bushes had baseball caps made of 41 and 43.
Oh, that's great.
They're very conscious of where they fall in comparison to one another, of where they fall in history, of the continuity amongst them. And those are the sorts of things, you know, again, where they are very aware that they are members of a very, very exclusive club. They don't talk about it publicly, but they certainly consult each other privately. They're always being approached to support causes or to appear at events. And so their staffs are in touch with each other all the time. They're very aware of, are you going to do this? Are we going to do this? What do you think? Should we all agree to do this national service, public service announcement together? Okay, yes, I'm in. Are you in? You know, they really do operate that way on many occasions. And since we're so used to looking at presidents as individuals, we thought we could come to a very different understanding of them, both as human beings and of this office, by looking at them together.
Nancy Gibbs is a visiting professor of practice at Harvard Kennedy School. She's also the editor-at-large of Time magazine and the co-author of The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The interview was recorded prior to Trump's election, therefore does not include a discussion about President Trump. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. The closeness that may develop between presidents and their vice presidents rarely continues after their term ends. But Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon seem inextricably bound to one another, partly as a result of Nixon's political tactics and also from the development of family ties. It wasn't a particularly good relationship, as our next guest has documented, but the relationship endured and shaped the United States politics and policy for decades to come. Jeffrey Frank is with us now. He is a journalist and author of several books, including this one, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Welcome, Jeffrey Frank.
Hi, thanks to be here.
It's great to have you here. I wanted to start with the general characters of these two former presidents, Dick and Ike, as you call them. It seems like they both had an enormous capacity for deception.
These were two men that could not have been less alike when they first met. And it was sort of like a dance around each other. Eisenhower, the whole country called him Ike, even though he was one of only four or five-star generals, and he was sort of a beloved figure. a truly beloved figure. He's the one who had led the Allied Expeditionary Force on the Normandy invasion. He was basically the leader who defeated the Nazis in Europe. Nixon, he was 62 years old, looked a little older, grandfatherly. He smoked three packs a day. That probably got to him. A lot of coffee and a war. Nixon was a 39-year-old Orange County senator at that point. And Eisenhower had met him briefly a couple of times, but they did not know each other. And although it's always said that Eisenhower picked Nixon, in fact, he was picked for Eisenhower by a number of advisors. Later on, Eisenhower was asked, you know, how did you actually select him? And Eisenhower said, well, it was a list of six people, and he was on the list.
Nixon had failed in a number of careers. How did he rise to the presidency, and how would you contrast that with Eisenhower?
Eisenhower basically won the presidency by acclamation. Both parties wanted Eisenhower to run. The Americans for Democratic Action wanted Eisenhower to run. Franklin Roosevelt's son, Jimmy, wanted Eisenhower to run as a Democrat. Everyone wanted Eisenhower. At one point, they were talking about having him run as a Republican and a Democrat. They would separate these two parties by having different vice presidents. That was just a notional idea. Nixon, on the other hand, struggled and struggled and struggled. And he had a rise and a fall and a rise again. And just to quickly go through his history, he ran for Congress in 1946, running against a five-term Democratic incumbent. He won partially because he was young and a veteran and a really good campaigner, partially because he was using the red issue, the communist issue, which was just beginning to show up. It wasn't as big as it was going to be after Senator McCarthy made his famous speech. And he won partly because he had the support of the Los Angeles Times, which at that point was not only the dominant paper, but the political director was also the man who wrote the editorials. He was the man who wrote a column, and he loved Dick Nixon, and he really wanted him to be in Congress. So he won that race. He won it pretty substantially. He won again. Then he ran probably the campaign that people never forgive him for, or at least Democrats never forgive him for, in 1950 against a woman named Helen Douglas, who was also a congresswoman. She'd had three terms. And that was his nastiest campaign. That's when the red issue really came in with full intensity. He was coached by a man named Murray Chotiner, who was sort of the Karl Rove of his day. Murray Chotiner, his sort of dictum was, destroy your opponent. That's how you win a race. And Nixon really went after her. And he won, by a substantial margin. He won by 600,000 votes. The only one who had a bigger margin in 1950 was Earl Warren, who became governor of California. And in the summer of 1950, Nixon was invited to the Bohemian Grove, this exclusive men's club north of San Francisco. And the host-in-chief was Herbert Hoover, the former president, who loved the Bohemian Grove. And he also invited Dwight D. Eisenhower, who at that point was president of Columbia University. And Eisenhower was invited to give a lakeside talk, the sort of important talk of the event. And people were already talking about Eisenhower for president again, this time as a Republican. Of course, no one at the Grove wanted him. They were really quite conservative, this bunch, and they wanted Bob Taft, a senator from Ohio, who sort of satisfied them. But anyway, Eisenhower was there, Nixon was there. They talked briefly, and that was their first meeting. And they met once more in Paris when I was helping to set up NATO. And then they showed up at the convention. Eisenhower was the favorite of the Eastern Republicans, and Nixon was kind of being pushed by a number of Eastern Republicans, including the former New York governor, Governor Tom Dewey, and of course his friend Murray Chotiner, which really annoyed Earl Warren, who hoped himself to be a favorite son candidate from California. This is the delegation that Senator Nixon was in.
The Bohemian Grove, you mentioned that you had a whole chapter on it.
Yeah.
And you said it's different from other exclusive clubs as well. How was it different?
Well, in one way, it was all men. They had these sort of rituals, the cremation of care ceremony. It was very secretive, sort of, less so now. You could actually go on YouTube and go to Bohemian Grove, and you'll see the torchlight parade and all that sort of thing. The clientele were wealthy businessmen, show business personalities. In those days, people like Edgar Bergen. Actually, the summer that Nixon was invited by Herbert Hoover, he wanted Conrad Hilton, the hotel guy, who thought they could maybe give them some tips on catering the summer. There were no women. And there still are no women allowed, I suppose partly because the men prance around naked at one point. But there are some women who help out with serving and so on. Herbert Hoover called it the greatest men's party on earth. And so it was a big deal. Nixon, later on in the tapes, was not very nice about it. But at the time, he was really happy to be there.
Now we have President Eisenhower, well, before he's president, when he's running, and he essentially lets other people choose Richard Nixon, Dick Nixon, to be his running mate. He didn't even know, as you said in the book, that he could choose the vice presidential candidate.
No.
And he never really liked Nixon all that much.
I won't say he disliked him, but he was never really fond of him. They were so different. As a general rule, he didn't like professional politicians. Tom Dewey, the man who sort of worked hardest, or one of those who worked hardest to get him nominated, guys still couldn't stand him. There are a couple of exceptions. Henry Cabot Lodge Jr., who was a senator, but he qualified as sort of being from a good old Eastern family. He was sort of an Eisenhower's sort of circle in a way. But no, Nick was sort of a scrappy hustler to Eisenhower and staff. He was still Lieutenant Commander Nixon, and Eisenhower was still General Eisenhower. You have to remember, by the way, that Eisenhower, when he left the presidency, did not want to be addressed as Mr. President. He wanted to be General Eisenhower.
You implied that they both had this ability to be kind of cruel, or that maybe even Nixon picked this up, cruel while appearing to be warm and kind.
Yeah, I mean, Nixon did some terrible things later on. But in their relationship, while Eisenhower was president and Nixon was under him, it was Eisenhower, and I'm not saying that even Eisenhower was intentionally cruel. It was sort of a casual cruelty, not being really aware of how he was deflating Nixon, hurting his feelings. I mean, he was constantly slighting him. I don't know if you want me to go into the fund scandal, but right after they were both on the ticket, Nixon went to visit Eisenhower in Fraser, Colorado. I'm not sure it was bonding or whatever. And Eisenhower tried to teach him how to fly fish. Eisenhower loved fly fishing. He loved bridge and he loved golf, none of which Nixon could do none of it. Nixon later on forced himself to learn golf. So they go off. Nixon's in the West Coast, and Eisenhower is sort of in the Middle West when the New York Post breaks a story called Nixon's Secret Fund. It wasn't really a secret. Nixon had actually told another reporter about it. It wasn't, by today's standards, it wasn't even much of a scandal. $16,000, all of which was accounted for in pretty good bookkeeping, was being used to supplement his office expenses. But it just didn't sound good, and it particularly didn't sound good at a moment when the Eisenhower campaign was, let's clean house with Ike and Dick. And by cleaning house, they were talking about Harry Truman and the Truman scandals. Harry Truman himself wasn't implicated in it, but the people around Truman were sort of, there were all kinds of things going on. Government contractors were, there's a 5% bonus that was being paid. Mink coats were being given out. Deep freezes were being given to people. Actually, Mrs. Truman got a deep freeze. And I think they claimed that, oh, well, it broke down, so it really doesn't count. So it was called the mess in Washington. So it really was bad to have even a taint of scandal. So Eisenhower, at one point, told reporters this, we have to be as clean as a hound's tooth. That was a famous thing. And he pretty quickly wanted Nixon to leave the ticket. The man Eisenhower was probably closest to all his life was his brother Milton, who definitely thought Nixon should go. But Eisenhower being Eisenhower, and Eisenhower was that he couldn't act directly. Eisenhower couldn't say, Dick, I want you off the ticket. He just let Nixon hang there, and they finally gave him the chance to go on national TV to explain himself. Eisenhower said, I want you to explain every nickel, every dime that's ever come in. And there was a sort of full-scale audit of all of Nixon's finances by Price Waterhouse. I think 50 people worked day and night. And so Nixon had to give this speech. And before he went on, he asked Eisenhower, so after I'm done, will you make a decision? And Eisenhower said, well, let's just give it a little more time. And Nixon said a very rude thing, which I can't repeat on the air, but in his memoirs, in one memoir it came out, General, there comes a time when you have to fish or cut bait. But that still wasn't. Just before Nixon went on the air and to give a speech that was going to explain everything, he got a call from Tom Dewey saying, Dick, I hate to tell you this, but we really think when you finish your speech tonight, you should resign from the ticket.
And
you
can, from the Senate,
and
right?
And you can really make yourself look good by giving up your Senate seat, too. And then you'll win in a huge special election. And you'll come back a hero. And Nixon just was speechless. He was already nervous, rattled, scared to death. His whole career was going down the drain. And he said, you'll just have to wait. And he did. He gave his speech talking about his finances, the mortgage, how much money he owed, what his parents were, how he'd grown up and worked in a grocery store. He did not mention that two of his brothers had died when they were young. And he finished the speech and mentioned, and it became called the Checker speech because he mentioned that the family had been given a little black and white Cocker Spaniel and his daughter Tricia named it Checkers. And he said, and we're going to keep it. People today look at it as this maudlin, oozy speech, even though actually Mamie Eisenhower apparently shed a tear. But if you look back at that time, in 1952, looking at a black and white television, this young guy under siege, the Milton Berle show goes off the air, and here's this guy speaking, begging for your understanding. And he defied Eisenhower. He said, write to the Republican National Committee and tell them what you think. And by gosh, thousands and thousands of people did just that, and Eisenhower was kind of trapped. Nixon beat him. The lieutenant defeated the general, and Eisenhower knew it.
This was one of the real attempts for Eisenhower to move Nixon out.
Yeah, that was the first one, the big one. Nixon's daughter, Julie, wrote about it. She said every September 23rd, which was the day that he gave the speech, he would say, you know what today is? It's the anniversary of that speech. And he said one time it was a scar that never healed. His wife, Pat, never got over it. She hated politics from that day on. It was a devastating moment. And even though Nixon went on and Eisenhower went on, that thing was always in the background, I think, between them, even though they never spoke of it again.
So he really outmaneuvered Eisenhower in this.
Yeah.
Was there another incident like that?
Well, 4 years later, Eisenhower was going to run for re-election. And this came after a very difficult and delicate moment. Eisenhower had a major heart attack. No one at the time knew quite how serious this thing was. In the first place, he was being treated by a doctor who really didn't know what to do. And for hours, this doctor sat with him, gave him morphine shots, and it was just by the grace of God that Eisenhower didn't die. In the morning, they called an ambulance. He was taken to the hospital, and even though he was critical, but he recovered. And during that time, government sort of went on without him. Really, no one was in charge. It was basically a government by committee. But Nixon really comported himself well. Everyone really got a high regard for him. He was dignified. He didn't try to assert himself. The press praised him. John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, really thought he'd done well. And that was a period when Foster Dulles, no one could have been less like Nixon than Foster Dulles. But Foster Dulles did like Nixon. He began to sort of mentor him in some way. Eisenhower, though, it did something to Eisenhower, the sort of seeing this young guy. And also, Eisenhower really, really wanted to get someone else. As he would say, we need to bring other people up. So he wanted Nixon replaced. They had several conversations in the spring of 56 after Eisenhower recovered and decided he was going to run again. At one time, he offered him a cabinet post. Nick, I think you want to be Secretary of Defense. It would be good for you to learn to run something. I think he said, you can have any job you want except state, which was going to go to Herbert Hoover Jr., which would never would have happened, or justice. And he thought Nixon didn't have the experience for that. But Nixon knew that if, whether or not Eisenhower was trying to help him or not, it would be perceived as if he'd been dumped. And so this went on. And Eisenhower said, I'm going to have a meeting. We're going to discuss the next election. And Dick, I would of course, invite you, but it could be difficult if you were there. So we're going to have this. And it went on. These conversations continued. And someone said it was a moment of absolute agony. And it wasn't like the Checker speech, because it went on and on and on. These conversations started basically in January, and they didn't end until April, when Nixon again kind of pushed himself back on the ticket. He managed to get himself a New Hampshire senator named Stiles Bridges, sort of organized a write-in vote in a primary in which Nixon wasn't running that showed Nixon had this powerful base out there. And finally, Eisenhower basically saw there was really no way to do it without basically having a public statement, I want him off the ticket. So Nixon survived. Though, even when Nixon thought he'd survived, a man named Harold Stassen, unquestionably with Eisenhower's assent, was trying to promote the governor of Massachusetts, Christian Herter, and then that failed too. And Nixon was not only renominated, but poor Harold Stassen was sort of pushed into doing the renomination.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Jeffrey Frank, and the book is called Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Joe McCarthy, very big role at the time. How did McCarthyism play into their relationship?
You know, everyone thinks that Nixon and McCarthy at a certain period were these twin spirits. And in some way, they were both very aggressive sort of red hunters in the 40s. Nixon was a member of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Nixon's reputation came because he went after Alger Hiss, a man named Alger Hiss. For better words, Alger Hiss was convicted of perjury for lying about having passed documents to the Russians. This is a case that people still want to argue about, but that's not the subject of this book. But that made his reputation. Eisenhower said to him, Dick, I think you got him, and you got him fairly. That's the way Nixon wanted to be thought of in the Hiss case. Nixon thought McCarthy was out of his mind, basically. He didn't use that language. He thought he was reckless. He threw charges out. He wasn't being a lawyer and became more and more irresponsible. And after he made his famous speech in 1950s about 205 communists, which then became 57 communists, and not one communist, by the way, ever was shown to be in whatever it was, the State Department, McCarthy took sort of going further and further and began to take on the army. And all kinds of, whether a man named Peres was promoted, it gets very complicated. But in any case, this was Eisenhower's beloved army. And after Adlai Stevenson made a speech saying you cannot have a party that's half Eisenhowerism and half McCarthyism, Eisenhower said, enough's enough, Dick, I want you to go on television and take both of them on. And Nixon was happy taking on Adlai Stevenson. He'd done that before. He'd done that in 52 when they ran against him. But taking on McCarthy was a very delicate thing for him, because he had to take on someone who was an anti-communist, and Nixon was an anti-communist, and he had to take on someone who represented part of the party's base, and Nixon didn't want to lose that, and yet he understood he had to do it. So he threaded this very delicate needle, and it came at a time after a famous broadcast by Edward R. Murrow had talked about McCarthy basically indicting people without evidence, and so it was somewhat easier, but he hated to make the speech. He hated to have being ordered to go on the air and attack Senator McCarthy. But he did it. And he did it by not mentioning McCarthy's name, but he said, you know, there are cases when people are accused of a crime and they have a right to face their accusers, they have a right to have a full hearing, and there are people today who are just recklessly throwing these things around. Everyone knew who he was talking about. So he did it, and he pleased Eisenhower. He really annoyed McCarthy, but McCarthy, a year later, was censured by the Senate, and Nixon went on to better things.
And this was also, of course, when the concerns over Vietnam were starting to bubble up. Eisenhower initially said that he didn't want to get the United States into another war. What was his strategy? What was Nixon's?
This was when the French were being defeated in a small little battleground called Dien Bien Phu. And Nixon had been there. Nixon had taken a big Asian trip a year before. He knew very well that if the French couldn't hold on, the people who were going to be governing this country was going to be, the Ho Chi Minh, the Viet Minh, the communist regime. They were the only ones capable of governing it. Nixon knew this, but he thought America should intervene. And that was the last thing Eisenhower wanted to do, was to get into any kind of war in Southeast Asia. He managed to get us out of the Korean War within 6 months after becoming president. And he could do it because he was Eisenhower. He was the five-star general. He was the supreme commander of the Allied forces. He had promised to visit Korea. He did go, and he basically saw, why are we sending troops in to try and take a hill that we're simply going to lose? This is an unsustainable war. Within 6 months of being president, we got out. There was an armistice, and in a way, that's the situation today. There's basically a ceasefire that's endured for 60 years or so. But Nixon thought we should help the French, but with air power. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, at one point Admiral Radford, thought we should send three nuclear bombs go in. We cannot even imagine what would have happened to the world if they had done that. This insane idea, but that was not going to go anywhere. And Eisenhower basically did all he could to stop any kind of involvement. He said, oh, we'll talk to Congress, knowing that Congress would have hated the idea. Well, we'll consult with our allies, knowing very well that Winston Churchill had no intention of helping the French preserve their empire, since the British had already lost their empire. And so Eisenhower very cleverly kept us away from any kind of war there. To be honest, though, Eisenhower did send money to the French. He helped pay for the French war there, and he sent them weapons. But our engagement in Vietnam was at that point limited to very, very little support. And he had helped prop up the Diem regime, which was then, as you know, overthrown when the Kennedys took office. And when he was overthrown, and by the way, this time Henry Cabot Lodge was the ambassador then, and then Lyndon Johnson became president, and the war was then escalated from Kennedy's 16,000 advisors to Lyndon Johnson's 550,000 soldiers, and the war that we've never forgotten.
And we have to talk about the civil rights era, because there was so much that occurred during this time, Brown versus Board of Education. There were a couple of civil rights bills over that period of time. Nixon supported them. Yeah. Eisenhower didn't. What happened?
Well, Eisenhower supported the bills because his party supported the bills. Eisenhower hated Brown versus Board of Education. He hated the idea. He thought it was completely disruptive of the society. It's not something he could say. And he was good about following the law. To jump ahead when there was a big crisis in Little Rock, Arkansas, Eisenhower did the right thing. And he did it in the way a general of the army would do it. He sent an overpowering force. No one was hurt, no one was killed, and the Little Rock Nine went to school. Martin Luther King Jr. met Nixon for the first time in Ghana at the independence ceremonies for the Gold Coast, which became Ghana. And he told people, he said, Nixon, he was raised a Quaker, and he seems to be without prejudice. And I think deep down, Nixon had prejudices. Everyone does. But outwardly, Nixon said and did the right thing, and he wanted to do the right thing about civil rights. In 1954, during one of his worst campaigns, he made a stop in Wilmington, Delaware, and someone said, what about, they brought up the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which had come out in May of 54, and Nixon made a very eloquent speech. He said, you know, my daughters go to school with Negroes, and over 600 million people in this world are not white, and if we're going to win their attention or respect, we have to show that we're a society that respects equality. And he meant it. He was the man who worked hard for the administration to support the 1957 Civil Rights Bill, which at the time was sort of a landmark. Lyndon Johnson is given credit for it, and Johnson certainly worked to pass the bill, but Johnson wanted a watered-down Voting Rights Act, and Johnson at that time was playing all kinds of games. He wanted to run for president, so he couldn't alienate the North, but he didn't want to alienate the Southern Democrats like Richard Russell. And Nixon pushed very hard, and the voting rights provision of the 57 Civil Rights Act was stronger because of the administration, and Nixon was the man working for it. Martin Luther King, who met with Nixon several times, praised him for it. Jackie Robinson, who was, I'm not sure he was a friend of Nixon, but they were very, very friendly, and he wrote Nixon congratulatory notes for all the great work you did. And it's important to remember that even the Nixon who later on supported the so-called Southern Strategy, he did work to desegregate Southern schools as president. And unlike George H.W. Bush, unlike Ronald Reagan, and unlike Goldwater, he supported the 1964 Civil Rights Act and did so publicly. He broke with Martin Luther King in 1960, or King broke with him because Nixon did something very cowardly. When King was arrested on a completely trumped-up charge, he had been arrested for driving without a license or something. He was sent in chains off to Reidsville Prison in Georgia. And when Mrs. King called, please help, she was terrified her husband was going to be killed. And she had very good reasons to think he might be. The police in Georgia at that time were horrible, what they were doing to black people in Georgia. And the Kennedy campaign, Bobby and or Robert and John Kennedy, stepped up and did something, and Martin Luther King was released. And I think it's clear that Nixon lost a lot of support from the black voters then. If he had won them, he very well might have carried a couple of more states and very well might have been president.
And you mentioned Kennedy, and that's another important point. He and John F. Kennedy were actually relatively close when they were in the Senate, but then things deteriorated.
Competition will do that to you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they were very friendly. I mentioned that really nasty campaign against Helen Gahagan Douglas. And shortly afterward, Kennedy spoke to some students at Harvard and said, I'm really glad that Nixon beat her. I would hate to work with someone like her in the Senate. Nixon was invited to the Kennedy wedding. When Kennedy was very ill with a back problem and Nixon was vice president and they had to reorganize the Senate, he preserved Kennedy's spot in the hierarchy. And Mrs. Kennedy wrote to him thanking him, saying she thinks the world of you. They were very friendly. And Nixon was asked to support Kennedy's membership in the Burning Tree Country Club and did so. But when Nixon was nominated for vice president, one of the first congratulatory notes came from Jack Kennedy. But, as I say, competition brings out the worst in everyone. When they ran against each other for president, there was a breach between them that would never heal. Kennedy began to speak with them with complete contempt. Nixon just said he was never going to lose an election that way again. He felt the Kennedys were ruthless, and he also felt the elections had been stolen from him.
And when the assassination occurred,
I think that was almost the worst thing that ever happened to Nixon. He was a happy guy then. He'd lost the governorship of California, sort of a humiliation. So that was it for California. He moved to New York. He joined a law firm. He was doing very well. He got an apartment at 810 Fifth Avenue, which is a very nice building. He was in the same building that Governor Nelson Rockefeller had an apartment. He was earning a lot of money. His two daughters, Tricia and Julie, were going to the Chapin School. Pat loved being in New York. They would go to musicals. They would walk down. Checkers was 12 years older. They would go strolling down Fifth Avenue. And Nixon swore to a columnist, he said, I'm never going to run again. I'm not going to run in 68, in 72, in 64. Anyone who thinks I'm ever going to run for office again is out of his mind. And I think he meant it. And then Kennedy was killed, and everything changed. Nixon could begin to taste it again. He could sort of see it again. There's no question he wanted to. He would have loved the nomination in 64. He already sensed that Lyndon Johnson was vulnerable. And when that wasn't going to happen, the competition came down to Barry Goldwater and Nelson Rockefeller. He already began to look ahead to 68. As a politician, he was like a brilliant chess player. He could see several moves ahead.
During this time, Eisenhower, now General Eisenhower again, had started being ill. He started having heart attack after heart attack.
Right.
How did he treat Nixon when he decided to run again?
He'd had several heart attacks, and as you say, and they got worse and worse. There was something else that was happening at this time, too. In 1967, Eisenhower's grandson, David, announced to the family that he was engaged to Julie Nixon, Nixon's younger daughter, which was an amazing thing. They were kids. They were 19 years old when they announced this, and they were going to get married. And in fact, a year later, when they were both 20 years old, they did get married. And so that influenced Eisenhower's decision. Eisenhower always didn't want to get involved in these nomination fights. He said, I'll support the party's nominee and that sort of thing. And it was a way to avoid supporting Nixon early. But this time there was no way out, and they were sort of a family now. He still waited till pretty much the last moment, but Eisenhower was pretty close to being on his deathbed when he endorsed Nixon. He endorsed him in the early summer of 1968, and in July of that year, Nixon got the nomination for president.
One of the funniest aspects of your book was when there was this famous quote from Eisenhower when a journalist asked about what major idea did Nixon offer you during your presidency that you then adopted, Eisenhower said.
Yeah, if you give me a week, I'll think of one. And that was 1960. It was devastating. Eisenhower told people, I wish I'd never said that damn quote and so on, but he said it. It took a while for him to take it back. Nixon was completely devastated by it. He really didn't know what to do. So what he did do, he went on a talk show and he had a chance to say, well, you know, Eisenhower, the president, is, of course, right. He does make the final decision, but he had also a chance to say that I was in on everything. I was a vice president. He included me in all of his councils and the cabinet and so on.
Before he passed away, he did get involved in Nixon's foreign policy to some degree. How much?
After Nixon was president, It turns out to be the first 2 months of the Nixon presidency. I would say the first 2 months of the Nixon presidency were a huge success. There was no war in Vietnam. I mean, there was the war. It was Lyndon Johnson's war still. Nixon had been warned by a very prescient columnist named David Halberstam, you have about 4 months to get to find a way to get out of this, or it's going to be Nixon's war. And, of course, that's what it turned into. He was being very inventive. The administration, you know, went on to sort of create the Environmental Protection Agency, sort of equal hiring, federal employment. The sort of universal food stamps came along. He had appointed Daniel Patrick Moynihan to sort of advise on domestic policy, and they came up with an idea for a negative income tax. Some of these things didn't go anywhere, but it was a very inventive, imaginative administration, and Nixon apparently would sit in some of these meetings himself. And in foreign policy, Eisenhower advised him to stay out of the Middle East, because once you put your hand there, then you become the guarantor of any agreement and so on. And Eisenhower got very involved. He suggested that Nixon should appoint Herbert Brownell, who had been Eisenhower's attorney general, to be on the Supreme Court. There was even some talk about Eisenhower being a sort of super advisor, but that never would have happened. Eisenhower was very, very ill. But Ike would pick up the phone and just say, "Mr. President, I've, you know," and so on. It was the one time when they, I won't say they were close, and they certainly weren't friends, but there was a real sort of almost equality between them. And they actually, and that Thanksgiving, they'd have a real family dinner together, because they were family now. How odd to think of that.
Again, the book is called Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. The author is with us, Jeffrey Frank. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
If we want to see our world in one piece.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series. Every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater, Monday, February 18th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Do the Right Thing, the Spike Lee joint which follows a Brooklyn neighborhood's racial tension on a hot summer day. Again, Do the Right Thing, showing Monday, February 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
This is DJ Love Jones, producer of the world-famous Confessional and DJ for Necropolis, starting every Sunday, midnight to 3 a.m. I want to personally invite you to come on out to the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, February 21st, starting at 7 p.m. Contessa de la Luna, host of the world-famous Confessional, will be live on stage reading your secrets and confessions prior to the movie. There'll be prizes, prizes, prizes. Come on out for a fun evening that benefits your community radio station, KBOO. That's Blazing Saddles, Thursday, February 21st, starting at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. See you there.